as you know, because I wrote to you. This is sort of a thank you interview, John. This is John Anderson, and what I have wanted to do for a long time is talk to you about, or have you talk to us, to share the spiritual knowledge and that wonder that's inside of you that expresses itself in your music. There's so much optimism about the whole future of the human race. And I'd like to know what you... Let's start off by maybe a little... What do you see happening to us?
Well, obviously, I always feel that everything is getting better. I certainly believe in the idea that it's a wonderful chaos that surrounds us. And sometimes I can actually pinpoint the problems, if you like, that if you look at a table...
Challenges.
You look at a table, so we're sitting at a table now, and you could say, well, this is the human condition, this table. And you can find a very small thing, I would think, maybe a lot smaller than this, but this is human beings. And you could say, well, this is all the anger and all the angst and all the aggravation. Yeah, very tiny. Because if you travel the world and you go to Barcelona today, or if you could go, you know, Yucatan, you could go all over the small towns in the middle of Uruguay, and people are just getting on with life, you know. There's no wars or angst. There are terrible things going on in certain parts of the world, but it's a very small part of being. Now, hey!
There it goes, that's the chaos.
That's a bit of chaos in the kitchen.
Right.
And if you then take the table as being the world, the size of the world and the oceans, the mountains, the flowers, the trees, the insects, the energies that are on this planet, you go to that same small spot, and that's the human condition. That's human beings. That's how small human beings are on the planet. And then you go one step further, which is kind of a little bit bizarre in some people's minds, but you can say again that the table is likened to our understanding of the world and the universe. And our understanding of the world and the universe is so tiny.
So it's a tiny piece of a tiny piece of
a tiny piece,
which is the bad stuff to start with.
Well, that's what we center in on, that through media. We always have them. We're always into there's no, you know, good news isn't fun, or good news isn't saleable, so they don't have too much good news on the news every day. So if kids are brought up to understand the news as being what really is happening, we're all in trouble, you know? And like Long Walker, my great friend, would say, one of the first things we do to children, we make them into consumers. We take them to the mall when they're little babies in the pram. We show them, this is what we do. We earn money to buy stuff. And that's all we ever teach them. We don't teach them about the real earth, the earth mother, the flowers, and the interdimensional elements of the planet, the fairy kingdom, various things like this that I've had to really, if you like, discover along my path. And as I've said, sometimes when you think about being on the path to knowledge and understanding, you are already on it. Just thinking that you want to get on it, you're already on it. And that's the whole idea. Now, I was very, very fortunate to have a wonderful upbringing, and I spent a lot of time alone when I was young, and I spent a lot of that time up in the mountains, the hills where I was born, and nature, and I just loved it.
What part of England was that?
This is like just north of Manchester. Just sort of very, very, very similar
like
to San Luis Obispo. But we did get snow and rain most of the time. But when I started making music, I was always aware of how wonderful music was, for one thing, and how it affected people. So when I was very, very lucky to become, you could call it successful, that was really a very strange time for me, because why would I get success, you know? Why me, sort of thing. So I started thinking, well, maybe I've got something to learn out of all this. So I started studying music. By the time I was 25, I started to play piano, which is very late in a life to start,
very late
to start playing piano, and learning and listening to Stravinsky and Sibelius, and I loved the Beatles, the Beach Boys, you know, the whoever was on the radio. I loved music totally, but I started to learn about Mozart and Delius and Elgar, and this is a great door swung open for me when I was about 25, 6 and 7 years old. And then with Yes, I was very, very fortunate to be with very talented musicians. Mm-hmm. And we just couldn't stop and stand around doing like 3 or 4 minute songs, trying to be sort of pop idols or pop success. We wanted to investigate more into the musical realm. So if you spend maybe 8 or 9 minutes doing a piece of music, what are you going to say lyrically? Mm-hmm. You know, this is a dangerous area. You can start... Well, most rock and roll is about having a good time and sex and drugs and rock and roll. And that's great. You know, I was always into that idea of having fun in life and stuff. But the mystery of life was the one thing that intrigued me. So I wanted to really lyrically delve into that mystery. So I started reading Hermann Hesse, you know, Journey to the East, Siddhartha. And this was like another door that sort of swung open.
As your path progressed this way, did people come along who were teachers or from whom you learned?
Well, I was always aware of the musicians that I was working with in Yes, and they were great teachers in a way. We were teaching each other. Uh-huh. One of the first real people that came into my life in 1971 was Vangelis. He was at that time living in Paris, and I'd heard about him. He was from Greece. He made music that I'd never heard before, very symphonic in style, very new.
Rock symphonic,
yeah. Mm-hmm. He had an album called Aphrodite's Child,
that. Mm-hmm.
Which was very famous, but the one that hit me was one called Creation du Monde.
Don't know it.
That's a beautiful album of very, very... earth organic music. So I went to Paris and knocked on his door.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah. Yes was pretty successful, mm-hmm. But I wanted to know who this guy was. So I went and just banged on the door. He opened the door and he was standing there with a bow and arrow. And he was like looking at me, hey. And he had this great big beard. And he was really big, you know, like about 300 pounds of, you know, wonderful guy. And he had a kaftan, you know. And there were these nymphets running around inside the house. And I just walked in and thought, gosh, it's like heaven. and he had the target for the bow and arrow right next to the television. And he'd get the bow and arrow and he'd let go. And the arrow would go all the way down this hallway and stick it into the target. And right next to the target was his father, Ulysses, watching TV. You know, it's like, I hope if he never missed, you know. There were some arrows went right out the window. And nobody knew what was going on out there. But there was a lot of tapes all over the floor, cassettes. And he'd play me stuff that, you know, would never be released. It was just so much energy coming out of this one person. Because he made all these sounds himself. He had these wonderful keyboards set up that nobody had ever tried before, like 3 or 4 different kinds of keyboards with 3 or 4 different kinds of echo and everything. And so I went back to London and we just invited Rick Wakeman to join the band. Mm-hmm. So I was saying, why don't you use 3 or 4 keyboards? And he said, oh, yeah, okay then. So 14 keyboards later, you know, Rick was playing all these keyboards on stage. That was, in a way, the start of the keyboard style, and it all emanated from Vangelis. Mm-hmm. And he was my mentor from then on.
That's incredible. I've been wanting so long to ask you this question. You have a line in Toltec that goes something like, I got over my fear and plunged into the inconceivable. That could take the next hour to just discuss. Tell me about getting over fear. That's a big one. And then having done that, I know you can't hardly describe the inconceivable. What are you talking about?
Well, it's the leap of faith, really. I think that's Carlos Castaneda was saying that in the book, that I was you know, Toltec is like a musical appreciation of Carlos Castaneda's work.
That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. And do you know Castaneda?
Not yet.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But one of his...
I know he's around somewhere.
Oh, yeah. One of his disciples was here a month ago, and we're working together on a project. And I think I know him. I think we all know him. I think
he's all part. In some ways, we all know each other.
Yeah,
anyway.
He's a part of all our lives. He's the pilgrim that we all want to be. Mm. He's the one that will go further than anybody, and we all want to achieve that openness to let go. Because in letting go, you are at one with Mother Earth or the Divine Mother. You know. And to leap into the inconceivable is very simple. You know, you actually have that leap of faith and you let go. You don't try to pretend that you're doing something, because in reality you're not really doing anything. You are a beautiful instrument on every level, you know.
But that doesn't mean sitting back and universe to shower you. Exactly.
No. It's a combination of balance. It's the will to want to be able to be a part of life, be a good energy to life, make it work for yourself. Because if you're not happy, you can't be happy to anybody else. And if you're not content, you can't be content with anybody else. Mm-hmm. And if you don't dream, you can't dream with other people. You know.
Oh, I love that about your songs. I love that you talk about the dreamer and the visionary as being a creative element. Mm. Have you found that in yourself?
Well, I'm very lucky these days. I found some beautiful herb tea called Incredible Dream Tea.
Really?
Yeah, and you can get it down at the store downtown there, and it actually opens up the dream potential amazingly. Mm. So
somebody gave me a dream catcher.
They're good.
And it's fabulous.
I've got three around my bed.
Oh, you know? It really makes a difference.
Because, you know, life is a dream. I always believe that we are in this dream, this norm, this arranged reality. We agree to be this situation now. Mm. And whenever I'm creating, I agree to want music to come through me into this reality. I can hear it all the time, music.
Do you?
Yeah. And sometimes it can send you a bit crazy because it's out there and you're trying to bring it into this reality so that you can put it down on tape and you can get it out to people who might enjoy listening to it. That's the main idea of being an artist, a musician, is trying to bring out something that they can feel that maybe somebody else doesn't quite feel at that time. So you want to bring it out for the next person who enjoys it.
Well, that I call it the trickle-down theory, because I had told you that there have been moments when I needed to speak with people and I needed something or someone to lift me up so that I remembered who I am, as it were. Mm. And that's been you often. Mm. So that trickles down and trickles down. So you talked about this thing of letting go, et cetera, et cetera. And I think personally that it's a group. It's a group of us that are learning together somehow.
You bet.
And I think you express that in your music and wondered... Somehow, have you been through experiences like with Yes, working together, or was there a point at which you recognized that this isn't just an individual thing, but that it's a large group of us doing it together?
I would think that once I was standing on stage in front of a lot of people and realizing they weren't looking at me, they were looking at their vision of me.
That's true.
And I would not take that ego and use it on any level. I think it happened very early. I was very lucky. Mm-hmm. I was famous for 10 minutes. I was happy. I was famous. I was a big star. But it didn't help me when I went to the bank. You know what I'm saying? So it's always something that hits you in the face and you say, wait a minute, I can't pretend to be famous, or I can't pretend to be any better than anybody else. I am just part of an incredible event in my understanding of the world, my understanding of creation. So I enjoy knowing that everything that I'm involved in is part of a whole thing, a whole happening. And sometimes when I'm in deep meditation, I see so many people meditating all over the world at that moment in time. And that's a great, refreshing feeling. to know that someone in Spain is there, someone in China is there, someone in Australia, all over the world, even little children, old people, just happy people, warm people, before they go on their daily routine. They're sitting there in harmony with the universe. And I feel that, not all the time. It's not like every day is my big sort of experience. Every now and again, I'll get that incredible oneness of being. Yeah. And through music, I'm always searching for a better way of explaining how I feel, explaining my experience of how I musically feel or lyrically feel. And most of the time, the best lyrics come when I'm not thinking.
Do you do the music first and then the...
It's a combination.
Or they come at once?
More than likely music. And at the same time, I get to myself in this situation where I remember working with Vangelis. I said, the first time I ever sung with Vangelis, I was just at the studio.
Was that Mr. Cairo?
No, it was an album he was doing called Heaven and Hell. And there was a song, he was playing the piano, and I started singing. And he said, wait a minute, put the microphone there. And he started again, and the tape was rolling. And I just sang a spontaneous song, and it said, once we did run, how we chased a million stars and touched as only one can. And the song became one of the only vocal song on the album. And I just sang it, and he said, that's wonderful, John, wonderful. I said, but you want me to do some harmonies? He said, no, that was just right. And a month later, the album was being released, and there was the song. So I realized working with Vangelis was a very spontaneous moment. So if you listen to Friends of Mr. Cairo, it's the first take. Totally. No rehearsal. You record the music, and then I would sing, and some of the lyrics would pop out, and all of a sudden, I would listen back to what I'd sung, rewrite the lyrics, of course, you know, and then just re-sing it one more time. Because it was that moment that was the spontaneous moment. And I didn't want to think about it more than a day. And that was, to me, a great musical
realization. Are you able to
do
a lot of music that way? Just really spontaneously?
I'm working on something at the moment that I recorded everything while I was washing up. I know it's a bizarre way of thinking, but I kept singing these Irish songs. I don't know where they came from, but I was...
Because you know Paddy was coming,
there you go.
Of course.
Of course. And there I was. I'm washing up, and I put the tape on, and I'd sing this song about something or other. And I finished up with about 14 songs, and I'm just getting them organized, because there's a wonderful Irish band in town. There's about six of them as a nucleus, and about eight other violin players, so you get a real hoedown going, you know. And hopefully...
Fierce Celtic music.
Yeah. So next month, I have a studio down in town there. It's an old church, beautiful place. And I'm going to get them all in there, and we're just going to have two or three days of drinking Irish whiskey and playing some great music, you know. And we're just going to see what happens, you know, because happily what I've learned is not to make music for business. If it's going to be on a label and it's going to get out there, fine. But first of all, make music for the sake of making the music. And that took me a while to understand. And that was, again, the leap into the inconceivable. You're never quite sure why I'm making music, because I've been told to make an album, because I've been told my bank manager needs more money to pay the mortgage to be able to keep going, because we've got to go on tour to make more money, because the manager thinks that's the only way, we'll survive. And eventually you're saying, why am I making music? And there were periods where we made music purely for the music, and sometimes we bumped into that, let's try and make a hit single, and it never happened. It was so bizarre, because I would say to the guys, it's not going to happen. Yeah, but we had one hit, it was called Horn of a Lonely Heart, so the next album's going to be 10 times bigger. It's not going to happen, because I know Horn of a Lonely Heart was like Twist and Shout La Bamba. It's the same song, just a different version. And it was a wonderful experience, but you can't live your life on expecting to be a hit. You know, you got to make music more for the potential growth of your consciousness. You can call it your spirit.
Wait a minute!
You know?
This is really great. So, making music not simply for the audience, but for yourself and for your own growth.
Totally.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So you're juggling like two worlds. How to survive in the 3D world, and then how to be that spiritual, that other dimension person.
All the time. Because you have to decide, first and foremost, that you are lucky to be doing what you're doing, and enjoy what you're doing, and what will come will be so wonderful. Mm. And the more, as I said before, the more I let go, the better the music is. Because I'm not impeding it by my trying to make it or form it into something more financially better, or more business-like or more hip. People would say, you know, why don't you do something a little bit more hip? And I say, well, listen, if you listen to Yes music of the 70s, it is timeless. We just recorded some of it last month in the 90s, and it doesn't seem like it's not hip. It's not cool, but it's still good music, and it will last a lot longer than I anticipated. Because when we did one album called Close to the Edge. It was a really good, moment.
That was long ago.
23 years ago. And it was a great moment to make that music. And it was based on the Sid Arthur, you always come back down to the river, you know, the river. Like the river is the sort of, it meets, all the rivers come to the same ocean. That was a basic idea. And so we made a really beautiful album, and then people would come over and say, this album will be still spoke about and still played in 10 years. And I'd say, nah, not possible. Thinking, well, I hope it lasts a couple of years, because we spent a lot of time making the album. But then here we are 23 years ago re-recording parts of it.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
1972.
Mm-hmm. That's when I went on the air, and I think that's when I first heard you was Close to the Edge.
Yeah. It was a great moment for me from any musical standpoint. First of all, the music was 20 minutes long. It had structure for the first time. We were creating structure, which I'd learned from listening to Stravinsky and Sibelius.
That's what you said.
And structure was important.
You mentioned some of the Romantic, Debussy. I don't think you actually...
Delius. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Delius, you said. So those are the romantic visionary musicians of the turn of the last century, right?
I believe that in the next 5-10 years I'll be making music because of listening to them. Mm-hmm. For the last 10-20 years, I've been making music because of Stravinsky, Mozart, and Sibelius. But now I'm more into the romanticism of music. So the next, I'm working on a love poem, and I'm working on a dance piece for the local dance company we're going to call Earth Mother Earth. That'll be about the goddess energy. And then we're doing the Celtic energy, which is very unknown. Not many people know what Celtic really is and what it really means. Mm. It's just a word that we associate with Ireland. But all European people
have
Celtic.
Celtic. Sure.
All European, because they started migrating, 25,000 years ago from Asia Minor, and all of the Russians, Italians, Spanish, Italian,
Austrian,
all the way Nordic. And then Ireland was the last bastion of the elders of the Celtic race. That was the last place where they finished.
Mm. It's like California, you can't go any further.
Exactly. And that is the power spot. Very powerful place. That's why it's been downtrodden for hundreds of years. And it was all to do with a stone, a beautiful stone of Skåne. And the stone of Skåne was the most powerful of the jewels, power stones, that were kept and have been kept throughout the ages. And that stone was stolen from the elders and put into the crown of England. And that's why we had this amazing 1,000 years of the English empire. It became the British Empire, but it was basically through the crown of England. And in 1913, the royal jewels were stolen for 2 days, and that stone was replaced. It's a true story.
I didn't know this.
That's why we've had the fall of the British Empire, and it is no longer any use. And the Celtic elders have got the stone, and they will come back into their rightful position in the year, in the next 10 years' time. Yeah. That's why there's going to be a new Ireland. Ire is going to become Ireland again, because you know you can't have an annex, Northern Ireland being controlled by the English government that doesn't really care.
Doesn't care.
For the Irish.
Not at all.
You know, because they don't know why they don't care. That's no, it's not a big problem. They don't know why they don't understand the Irish people. It's simply because they've forgotten all about the fairy kingdom. Now people will say, John, you've lost it. And I say, thank God I've lost it too.
Yeah. I just read in a book of Celtic wisdom that the side, S-I-D-H-E, which is where the fairies and spirits are, is exactly this world that we're in, but they can access us, but we don't know how to access them.
They're in
them.
A faster dimension than ours. It's right parallel. And it's actually where laser comes from, the laser phosphorus energy. I was very fortunate.
Well, those little bitty silver things you sometimes see in your eyes.
Yeah. I saw a diva, you call them a diva, fairy.
Yeah, oh, diva, definitely.
And on my 40th birthday, they came to meet me, because I've been reading... Up until then, 6 months, I've been reading this beautiful book called A True Fairy Tale. And that was written by a lady in North London called Daphne Charters. And it was a true story, and is a true story. Anyway, I've been reading this beautiful little book about how the fairy kingdom works and how we don't really see things. We look at a tree, but we don't see it for what it really is.
Right.
And that's the whole... essence of knowing, A, there's a fairy kingdom, B, you want to make contact, they'll come, and they'll meet you halfway. As you said, we cannot get into their world, but they can come to our world anytime they want. But they do, and they use it. It's part of their wonderful nature. They love and still love human beings, and they always trying to help us. They're always living in very difficult times through living in hard concrete environments they don't particularly like, but they do it out of a beautiful knowledge of all that is. And if you read the book, or by chance get a copy, it will explain how it works. And that night of my birthday, I was lying there in bed and I just saw this beautiful spark in the room. I was in on an island called Tioman near Singapore, and I was in this hotel. And then this little blue spark was flying around. I'm thinking, well, that's not a firefly, because it's not going on and off. And I was seeing it, and it stopped. And it saw me, and I saw it, and it got bigger and bigger and became these two beautiful wings, big hands. It wasn't a Walt Disney fairy, sorry. It was just this glorious vision of phosphorus energy. And it came and floated right over my head and told me things that I can't explain now, because I still can't remember exactly how.
But it's in there.
Oh yeah, of course it's there. Because they said they wanted. We used to co-create with the fairy kingdom many thousands of years ago, 3,000 years ago, and they are ready to help and co-create with us once more.
That's what we have to do.
Well, they sent us the laser beam. They said, "Hey, you can have it back," because we used to have it, as you know, in Lemuria and Atlantis in those days. And they've given it to us back. And look what we're using the laser for. We're using it for all sorts of magical things. Healing. So many laser, you know, we make our music, laser discs.
Right.
You know, little laser beams.
Yeah.
And visual television, the laser screen is coming. Laser sound reproduction is coming.
Is
no more speakers. But that's the future. And that's the fourth dimension, which we're slowly moving into.
Like what's the fourth dimension?
Well, it's a higher knowledge. What is it? Well, it's a higher knowledge than the third. It's
okay.
More, well, it, you know, when you think about it, we're working with computer knowledge. Now, computer, like anything, is... information. It's an amazing adventure within itself, the computer.